1985. We're here in the studio, and things are happening for real. As mentioned, tonight's Radio Free America broadcast, running until 11 o'clock tonight, will deal with the assassination of Martin Luther King, which, again, this is the 17th anniversary of that tragic event. We are going to be talking about a variety of things that you haven't heard before. We're going to be relating some of the things that you may have heard before to this self-same occurrence, and we're going to be putting some things together in some ways you probably never thought about before. I should just mention to those of you perhaps who had recognized the song that I just played, because I found out that some other people weren't aware of this, that the song I just played, of course, U2, by U2, called Pride in the Name of Love, is about Martin Luther King. And when Bono and the boys were in the Bay Area recently for their the concert, we have to perhaps put some of these things in perspective, especially for some of our younger listeners who perhaps know of these events that we're talking about and fail to understand quite exactly what was going on. Again, for those of you who were not, I guess the phrase would be politically aware in the 60s, it's perhaps hard to represent exactly what was going on, and perhaps hard to understand exactly what the death of Martin Luther King, Robert F. Kennedy, and John F. Kennedy before that in 1963 meant. And bear in mind also that Robert F. Kennedy died within 3 months of Martin Luther King, the same year, 1968. One of the things to think about is the fact that the 60s, for whatever reasons, all right, now of course a lot of historical revisionism has been done about John F. Kennedy's presidency, and there certainly are many sides to take on the value of John F. Kennedy's presidency, but one thing that seems to be, I think, almost unarguable is that in many quarters, and especially among young people in the United States in the early 1960s, the advent of John F. Kennedy as president began to give people a feeling that perhaps times were changing, that things were happening, that the time had come to shake off some of the mistakes of the 40s and 50s, some things that we have detailed in past Radio Free Americas, especially we've talked about the beginnings of the Cold War in some depth, and the time had come to begin looking at relationships anew. Now, this is not, again, necessarily all because of John F. Kennedy's policies himself, but because of a convergence of a number of factors, and John F. Kennedy's image certainly being one of those, and the matriculation of a very politically aware generation in high schools and colleges at that time. 1968 was a focal year. 1968 was the year that Lyndon Johnson announced that he would not be seeking a second term as president, would not be running for re-election because of the strength shown by Eugene McCarthy in the New Hampshire primary, where it became very obvious that a large section of the Democratic wing of the party, the Democratic Party, would be voting an anti-war ticket. There was, of course, much support on college campuses and other places for the anti-war philosophy. Much of this anti-war philosophy had sprung out of the involvement of many white middle-class students with their black middle-class and lower middle-class and lower-class, you know, just plain poor kindred in the Southern Freedom March and the Southern voting marches and all kinds of civil rights activities. So these were basically direct outshoots, many of them, what was going on in 1968, of the civil rights movement. And when Lyndon Johnson dropped out, it became obvious that whoever the Republicans were going to be nominating in 1968, barring a miracle, that he would almost certainly be facing either Eugene McCarthy or, when he declared a few weeks later, Robert F. Kennedy, both of them avowedly anti-war, anti-Vietnam candidates, and both would be getting the support undoubtedly of people like Martin Luther King, who was undoubtedly the most powerful force in civil rights, and in many ways the most powerful because of his non-affiliation, the most powerful political force in the country at that time.
A couple of things to remember, too, is that shortly before about a year before Martin Luther King was assassinated, he had shifted his political focus not only from civil rights, but towards criticizing the Vietnam War, the growing expense of the Vietnam War, both in terms of money and human lives, and in terms of political energies, was detracting very significantly from the progress of the civil rights movement. Now, on November 22, 1963, John F. Kennedy was assassinated. On April 4th, 1968, 17 years ago today, Martin Luther King was assassinated. On June 5th, 1968, Robert Kennedy was assassinated. And on the 18th of November, 1978, 900-plus followers of the Reverend Jim Jones People's Temple allegedly committed suicide in the jungles of Guyana. Now, this evening, we're going to be presenting a number of connecting links between those events, among other things. And for those of you who might think that this seems a little fantastic, well, stay tuned, because we're going to present some information. The main focus this evening is the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're going to present it in a context of a number of other different events.
One last thing I would want to mention, again, to the people, obviously those who were alive and politically active, or at least politically aware during these times, do not need to be told this, but since a lot of our listeners are younger, something that needs to be made plain, and that is the heat of feelings involved at that time and the extremity of reaction that was going on. Now, again, we live in comparatively placid days. Some people have compared the current era, I think somewhat facetiously, but nonetheless comparisons have been made, to a second Eisenhower era. Well, one of the things to be borne in mind is that, of course, the man who was piloting the country at this moment, Ronald Reagan, basically got his political start in the 60s as a reaction and representing the reactive forces of people who were scared to death by any idea of civil rights, non-U.S. intervention in countries where it basically had no business being and things of that nature. Now, to give you an idea, Ronald Reagan at the time suggested, at the same time that Martin Luther King, among others, was beginning to come out strongly against the Vietnam War, Ronald Reagan suggested that the United States go ahead and make the Vietnam War an officially declared war for the very express purpose of then being able to take people who protested the war out and have them shot as traitors. Now, this was coming from a public figure at the time who was a governor. This was the kind of thing being expressed by a lot of public officials, and if this was the climate involved at the time of the country when literally dozens of people's heads would be beaten in the streets of Chicago in front of the Democratic Convention, you can imagine that the slightly more extreme elements of our country might be prepared to carry things even farther. And, of course, that is pretty much what happened, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Now, the first thing we're going to be presenting this evening is the official version of the assassination of Martin Luther King. Now, the first section that we're going to read here comes from a book called Government by Gunplay, subtitled Assassination Conspiracy Theories from Dallas to Today. This book was edited by two members of the Assassination Information Bureau, one Sid Blumenthal, last name Blumenthal, also a man named Harvey Yazijian, Yazijian. There is an introduction to the book by Philip Agee, and our first, actually an essay upon which we're going to be relying very heavily, which sort of neatly sums up a lot of the key pieces of information about the King assassination, is an essay called The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen.
Okay. Again, this is the official version of the assassination of Martin Luther King.
The book, by the way, is published in softcover by Signet Books, copyrighted 1976.
On April 4th, 1968, Dr. Martin Luther King was shot dead in Memphis. According to the state's scenario, King was killed by a lone assassin, James Earl Ray. Ray, serving a 20-year armed robbery sentence in a Missouri prison, had escaped in April 1967. Although lacking a known source of income, the prison escapee spent over $10,000 in three countries before deciding, on his own, to kill King. The state says Ray fired one shot from the second-story window of a Memphis rooming house and struck King, who was standing on the Lorraine Motel balcony across the street. Ray then raced down a flight of stairs, dropped his rifle and other belongings on the sidewalk, ran a few steps to his white Mustang, and drove off. Within 24 hours, Attorney General Ramsey Clark announced there was, quote, no evidence of conspiracy, unquote. But Ray, the unaided assassin, wasn't captured until 2 months and three aliases later at London's Heathrow Airport. On March 10th, 1969, Ray pled guilty to murder in exchange for a 99-year sentence. The state explained that Ray's motive for murder was a hunger for status and recognition in white America.
Now remember that James Earl Ray was what's known as a five-time loser. He had been unable to pull off five relatively mundane crimes without being caught. And he not only was able to assassinate one of the leading public figures and political activists in the United States at that time, and in the world, in fact, a Nobel Peace Prize recipient, but he was able to conduct an international flight using three aliases, which just happened to be the names of real people in Canada who bore a very strong physical resemblance to James Earl Ray, even down to scars. He was then able to, again, with the $10,000, which nobody seems to know where that money came from, to effect a very, very effective and very sophisticated flight to London. Now, James Earl Ray has said, basically, that he was part of a conspiracy, and what we're going to be doing this evening is laying out the information which we think will bolster the claim that Ray has made, that basically he was part of a conspiracy and not a lone nut.
Now, again, this is something important, that despite the guilty plea, which we'll be examining in some depth how the guilty plea came about, James Earl Ray has always adamantly denied that he actually shot Martin Luther King, very much the same way that Lee Harvey Oswald, when he was arrested, unlike, and again, I have to go over this for people not familiar, time and time again, in the case of political assassinations, and it only seems to happen in the United States for some reason, we're given this psychological profile of the lone madman, you know, who decides that he's going to either A, impress Jodie Foster, or B, attain status in white America, or whatever the case may be, and conceives a lunatic desire to shoot a public figure and then shoots them. Okay. Unfortunately, even the people who construct these psychological profiles agree that the people doing these kinds of things would then immediately come forward and say, "Hey, I did it. It's me. I'm guilty. I'm the one," right, to attain their martyr status or their celebrity status or whatever the case may be. Again, like Lee Harvey Oswald, who denied right up until the moment of his murder any involvement with the assassination of John F. Kennedy, James Earl Ray has consistently said that he was part of a group of people, that he was a patsy, that he never pulled the trigger, and that the guilty plea was obtained from him, not unwittingly, but unwillingly, and we'll show you why.
Again, returning to the essay, The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen. Cohen writes, Ray has a very different explanation of the odyssey that began with his escape from a Missouri state prison and ended five countries and 2 years later in a Tennessee state prison. He escaped a year before King's slaying, quickly taking a dishwashing job in Chicago for 8 weeks. No one at the restaurant indicated that Ray held racist feelings toward any of his 22 black co-workers, several of whom worked close to Ray. By the way, remember now that, interrupting here, that supposedly James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King not only because he was a racist and hated blacks, but because he wanted publicity. So it's significant that he showed no overt racism or detectable racism to his 22 black co-workers. Continuing with Cohen's essay, he moved on to Canada, where he hoped to secure a passport for a South American country that had no extradition agreement with the United States. In Montreal, Ray hooked up with Raoul, R-A-O-U-L, that's spelled, a red-haired French-Canadian smuggler whom he claims killed King. Raoul offered him $12,000, a passport with matching ID, and assistance in going, quote, anywhere in the world, unquote, in exchange for a little joint smuggling activity, unquote, according to Ray. Raoul proceeded to move Ray around the North American continent like a pawn on a chessboard. Ray carried packages across the Canadian border into Detroit and smuggled valuables hidden in a spare tire through Mexican customs. For these and other errands, Raoul rewarded the prison escapee with over $10,000 in spending money between August of 1967 and April 4th of 1968, Ray said. Ray's last assignment for Raoul was to purchase a rifle for a smuggling deal. He admits that he bought the rifle, but that it wasn't with my money, unquote. Ray exchanged the first rifle, apparently on Raoul's orders. I understand the first one was the wrong type, and I had to take it back and get another, unquote, he said. The man who sold Ray the rifles said he seemed to know very little about guns, according to Arthur Haynes, Ray's first attorney. Ray told Haynes that the gun he bought was taken from him by Raoul at a motel in Mississippi on April 2nd. Within seconds of the April 4th shooting, that rifle with Ray's fingerprints was dropped at the murder scene. The rifle was found inside its carton, wrapped in a bundle with Ray's other belongings.
Continuing, James Earl Ray had come to Memphis on April 4th for what Raoul had advertised as a gun-smuggling operation, which would make Ray rich. Quote, Raoul told me he was going to meet this gunrunner at 6 p.m., and that the gunrunner would speak more freely if I was not there, meaning in the rooming house. Raoul gave me $200 and told me to go downtown and see a picture show, unquote, Ray told former Memphis Press Scimitar reporter Wayne Chastain. The Scimitar is a leading daily newspaper in Memphis. Although Raoul had instructed Ray to leave his Mustang at the rooming house, Ray took the car to pump up a low tire, figuring he'd have enough time to return it by the designated hour of 6. Ray's alibi witness is a black gas station attendant, Willie Green, who filled the tire a little before 6 p.m., 3 blocks from where the state alleges Ray killed King at 6:01. Ray recalled seeing an ambulance pass by the gas station. His watch said 6:05. Quote, I drove back, but when I got to the rooming house, police were swarming all over the place. One yelled, get out of here. Ray smelled trouble. Maybe Raoul had been trapped by police agents. He made a U-turn and headed toward Atlanta. Quote, I turned on the radio and heard what happened. It wasn't until then I learned I had been associated with the men who killed Dr. King, unquote. The state's lone assassin theory fails to explain how Ray acquired the three aliases he used in flight, Eric Stavro Galt, Eric S. Galt, Paul Bridgman, and Ramon Sneyd, S-N-E-Y-D. All are real men from Toronto who bear a strong resemblance to Ray. Galt even has similar scars. Ray fled by land to Toronto, took the first plane flight of his life to London on a Canadian passport under the Sneyd name, and was arrested at the London airport after a side trip to Portugal.
Continuing. Although details of his alibi have changed, Ray's connection to a Raoul-like handler has been verified. William Bradford Huey, last name H-U-I-E, retraced Ray's journey and substantiated much of his story. Huey's detailed ledger on Ray's finances indicated that Ray was continually supplied with $20 bills and that Ray magically came upon $2,000 the day he purchased the white Mustang. That was the car that Ray had used for his smuggling purposes for Raoul, by the way. Huey could not find a string of unsolved robberies along Ray's path. Huey also verified the details of Ray's smuggling runs. Ray would carry the contraband across the border while Raoul would cross clean and repossess the goods from Ray on the other side. Both Haynes, once an FBI agent on the Mexican border, and Foreman, that's Percy Foreman, Ray's second attorney, who has defended syndicate drug smugglers, believe that Ray hooked up with a Raoul-like criminal contact in Montreal. The way he tells it is standard operating procedure for bringing heroin in from Canada, Foreman confirmed. Men like Raoul in Montreal are always looking for Americans like Ray, desperate fugitives, and the Raouls always cross the border in planes, taxicabs, or buses, while the Rays cross in their cars. Now, the next thing that we're going to present you is some information which will give a little more depth on what may lie behind the Raoul syndicate, the smuggling syndicate, and Ray's and Raoul's involvement in carrying contraband and other things across borders.
Okay, this next section here is is still from the essay by Cohen. It's going to talk a little bit about a man named Robert Byron Watson. I just want to make a couple of points real quickly because it is a kind of a tangled story, Watson's is. The story is that Watson alleges that not only does he have knowledge of the assassination of Martin Luther King, but that he himself also has knowledge of illegal drug smuggling, and the people involved with killing King were also involved with smuggling drugs and other objects. And Watson himself is currently in jail on charges that he says were framed, and although nobody has really seemed to try too hard to find out if his information about the King killing was valid, some attorneys and other people involved in law enforcement have conceded that about 95% of his drug information is valid. So that's just to kind of give you a shorthand. Now I'm going to read you the actual section. The newest lead in the case comes from a 21-year-old Robert Byron Watson, who, as a high school student, worked part-time for an art import business in Atlanta. The young employee says he soon realized that the business was actually a front for a gun-exporting, drug-importing operation. On the afternoon of March 28, 1968, Watson claims to have overheard a conversation involving the four business partners and several strangers. Quote, this is Watson speaking. I heard one partner saying in a very clear voice that he was going to shoot that damn nigger bastard King in the head and frame a jailbird just as they had Kennedy. Another partner said that they would kill Dr. King exactly 1 week from then to the day and about the same time of day, unquote. The conspirators, Watson states, left the country shortly after the murder and didn't return until Ray was apprehended in London 9 weeks later. Watson contends he has been beaten, blackmailed, and framed by corrupt drug enforcement agents because of his attempts to expose his boss's illegalities. From his current residence in federal prison, he has released a rambling 34-page affidavit packed with names and dates, addresses, and phone numbers. Atlanta police began investigating Watson's affidavit in June 1975. Detectives talked with 11 law enforcement agencies and 35 witnesses. A police spokesman stated in early July, quote, "This is not a routine investigation. Much of the information appears to be true. It could open new leads involving a conspiracy," unquote. As the investigation continued, however, Atlanta's black police commissioner accused the FBI of being uncooperative. By the end of July, the commissioner, Reginald Eves, announced that while, quote, "names and places and dates have been corroborated, involvement of individuals named as conspiring to kill Dr. King could not be substantiated." Eves told the TV audience in November 1975, quote, "We could not establish a conspiracy because of a limited geographical control. Our investigation indicates a strong possibility of conspiracy."
So although the final book is not in yet on Robert Byron Watson's affidavit, the leads are very hard, and one of the things that, one of the aspects of research methodology in the assassinations is to take note of the fact that basically the cover-up will obviate the conspiracy. If there's nothing there to hide, people don't go to some length to hide it, and Robert Byron Watson was framed and blackmailed and underwent a number and imprisoned and underwent a number of other unfortunate occurrences for having attempted to get this information out. Now, a very good analysis of the Robert Byron Watson affidavit was presented in a publication called the Hudson Valley Chronicle. That was an alternative, well, sort of a small private paper that was published in New York State in the 1970s. This is from Volume 1, Number 1, from July of 1977. Research credit for this goes to Mae Brussell, who's the Dean of Researchers in this field. Her World Watchers International series is aired on this station and is one of the best sources for information on this subject. And Mae is really the first and, to date, practically the only researcher to come to grips with the Robert Byron Watson affidavit. And contained within this affidavit and the analysis of that that we're going to be reading to you are a number of very interesting, very hard leads to the facts concerning the assassination of Martin Luther King. And interestingly enough, a number of connecting links between the King assassination and some other assassinations, notably those of John and Robert Kennedy, and some other aspects of political skullduggery that we're going to talk about here in just a minute. Now, this article is entitled, this again, from the Hudson Valley Chronicle, July of 1977, Volume 1, Number 1. The article is entitled, "King Assassination Conspiracy Revealed." This is by a man named David Wemple, W-E-M-P-L-E. And Wemple writes, "Through nearly a decade of threats, blackmail, beatings, and murder attempts, Robert Byron Watson has steadfastly maintained that both the United States federal government and the forces of organized crime have persecuted, framed, and imprisoned him for one reason and one reason only, that he possesses knowledge implicating agents of these groups in a conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and others. For those willing to hear his story, it should become readily apparent why the endless mysteries of America's political assassinations remain unsolved. When the intimacy existing between government, organized crime, and the intelligence community is laid out before one's eyes, it must seriously be questioned whether or not our present form of government can weather the intense scrutiny to which such knowledge must lead us. Watson was but a young man when on March 28, 1968, he claims to have overheard a portion of the conspiracy to murder Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. As an acknowledged authority on art history and archaeology, even by those whom he most closely identifies with the conspiracy, he became employed at Magellan's Art Gallery in Atlanta, Georgia, and worked at the pricing of various artifacts." Magellan, by the way, is M-A-G-E-L-L-O-N. "The gallery's business associates were fighting amongst themselves, however, by Christmas of 1967. It wasn't until a year or so later that Watson learned of the reason for this split. Bill Arnett, A-R-N-E-T-T, one of the original gallery partners, had apparently begun to suspect several others of using the gallery to front for illegal operations involving what Byron Watson consistently refers to in statements as, quote, the syndicate, unquote. The type of individual who often found his way to the halls of Magellan's, according to Watson, was characterized by a rather frequent visitor named Larry McDonald. A United States representative from Georgia, McDonald reigns from Marietta, from which the awesome and scandal-ridden Lockheed Corporation bases its East Coast operations. Aside from his membership on the John Birch Society's National Council, McDonald has been accused by the U.S. Labor Party and others of acting as a conduit for intelligence operations and various ultra-right-wing groups. In the meantime, he has gained a notoriety of sorts by saturating the congressional record with tirades like Maoist subversives in U.S. factories and Martin Luther King Jr.'s relationship with the communists. Within such an atmosphere of reactionary politics and corruption, says Watson, syndicate operations flourished, which included gold bullion smuggling from South America, as well as the importation upon a truly vast scale of cocaine and heroin. Now, before we continue with Wemple's analysis of the Robert Byron Watson affidavit, I think it might be worthwhile here to stop and mention a couple of things. First of all, the aforementioned interrelationship between the intelligence community, the defense industry, and organized crime is a very important complex to understand, one which will certainly be the subject of a future Radio Free America broadcast. It's something that we've talked about a great deal on our programs, that Mae Brussels has been talking about for years on her World Watchers International series, and it involves one of the main complexes of subterranean politics today. Larry McDonald, of course, was a fellow who is very much was until his demise in the crash of Korean Airlines Flight 007, was very much involved with the far right in this country. He had an ultra right wing data bank and research group called Western Goals, and he basically was one of the guiding lights of the far right. And in the Robert Byron Watson affidavit, he makes it very clear that a great deal of Larry McDonald's capital comes from this drug smuggling, this gun and gold bullion smuggling operation, which is referred to subsequently here as the syndicate. Now remember, organized crime, intelligence, the defense industries, this is a complex that we've talked about a great deal, and it's something that we'll touch on again throughout the course of the broadcast, and it's one of the main themes of our programs here on KFJC.
Okay, skipping along in the article. The operation into which Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail. Now, what this is referring to is that Byron Watson went to the feds, basically went to the feds with his story about what he had heard, referring to these people that he worked with talking about the Martin Luther King assassination and the fact that they were involved in it. Was basically laughed at by the feds. Nothing much came of it. He himself was told then, when he got back to his job, it had been discovered somehow that he had visited the feds. Now, whether that implies that somebody in the government offices told his employers that he had been to talk to the government about those same employers or not. Anyway, whatever it was, according to Watson, his trip to the federal government had become quickly known. They told him that either he could play ball with them or that he and his mother, who had been involved in helping him to go to the government, would wind up dead very quickly. So he claims that he was then blackmailed into becoming more involved in the operations of this art gallery come smuggling haven. Says, the operations into which Byron Watson gradually became involved through this blackmail brought him an ever-increasing knowledge of organized crime and its relationship to the U.S. federal government. Although deeply involved in narcotics-related activities, he steadfastly maintains that he never took an active role in the actual trafficking, and that any, quote, evidence of this has been fabricated in a successful attempt to have him framed and imprisoned for the knowledge which he possesses. His awareness of drug smuggling activities, however, is substantial. While visiting Southeast Asia and purchasing huge amounts of artifacts for sale at Magellan's, for instance, he noticed that his traveling companion, Bill Jackson, was buying large quantities of teak logs. They were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. I should just mention that Bill Jackson, mentioned here in the article, is one of the people, I believe, that was mentioned as, along with Gene Purcell and Bill Jackson's brother, Herman Jackson, as being the people that were having a discussion with Jerry Adams about these people all, of course, being Byron Watson's employers, about the assassination of Martin Luther King. We're going to get back to Herman Jackson a little later on, but remember that Herman Jackson is one of the people involved in this, and this is his brother Bill Jackson that Watson is claiming was involved with buying these teak logs. Okay. These teak logs were hollowed out at points, filled with narcotics, and shipped back to the U.S. A good deal of this information was forwarded by Watson to Atlanta Public Safety Commissioner A. Reginald Eaves. Eaves, whose, quote, conscience forced him to launch an investigation of Watson's charges in the summer of 1975, conceded that his drug-related data, at least, had proven to be, quote, about 95% accurate, unquote. The leads which Watson has provided in regards to the intimacy between government and syndicate, as well as about political assassinations, therefore may well be something to be reckoned with.
Now remember this Robert Byron Watson information. We're going to be coming back to that in a couple of different respects. We wanted to present that to you so that you'll have a little bit of background as we not only recite some of the contradictory evidence, some of the evidence presented by eyewitnesses which contradicts the official version, as we present the strange information from the lone witness to connect James Earl Ray to the spot from which he allegedly fired the fatal shot. Remember the syndicate, as Robert Byron Watson refers to it, this guns, drugs, and gold smuggling operation running out of the Magellan Art Gallery. Incidentally, another thing you might want to remember is that Mark David Chapman, the slayer of John Lennon, was not only from the DeKalb County area, which and Robert Byron Watson mentions that the syndicate had been controlling various municipal or various county officials in DeKalb County, but he also spent a lot of time at art galleries, so it remains to be seen whether there's any connection there. But remember the Robert Byron Watson information, in particular the complex of arms and drug smuggling and the interrelationship between organized crime, the intelligence community, and the defense industry, because we're going to come back to the Jacksons, in particular Herman Jackson, only we're going to encounter him by a different name and a little later here. Going back to the essay, The Assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen. Not a single eyewitness could place Ray at the murder scene. Bessie Brewer, the rooming house manager, said she could never identify Ray as the Mr. Willard, unquote, who rented room 5B from her. Brewer said the man was in his late 20s and slightly built. James Earl Ray was 40 and husky. Two other rooming house dwellers gave exculpatory eyewitness statements. Bertie Reeves said Ray was not the man who he saw rent the room. Harry Ace Locke said three men were in room 5B about 2 hours before the shooting. He would not identify Ray as one of them. One of the shoddiest aspects of the police FBI investigation was the selection of Charles Q. Stevens, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S, as the state's star witness. On the night of the slaying, Stevens, a roomer, told Memphis reporter Wayne Chastain, quote, I saw who done it. It was a nigger. I saw him run out of the bathroom. I will never testify against the man who killed Martin Luther Coon, even if it were a nigger who done it. Bessie Brewer overheard Stevens' statement and told reporter Chastain to disregard it. Quote, he was so drunk, he didn't see or hear anything, unquote. Lloyd Jowers, the manager of Jim's Cafe, located below the rooming house, testified that Stevens was inebriated that afternoon. Cab driver James McGraw testified at the 1974 hearing that Stevens was drunk at 5:45 p.m., 15 minutes before King was killed. Stevens, who had pointed for a cab, quote, was lying on the bed and couldn't get up. He was falling down drunk, unquote. Private Stone, a fireman, stated that Stevens visited the nearby station, quote, every night at 6 p.m. intoxicated, unquote. According to press photographer Ernest Withers, the day after the murder, Stevens didn't recall that someone had been shot at all.
Continuing, Stevens' original statement to the police was that he saw nothing, that he was in the kitchen where he could not see what happened. Accordingly, he was ignored by the police and FBI. But 6 weeks later, Stevens declared that his memory was reawakened after Ray's picture appeared on the front pages. The man he saw was not only Lily White, he said, but was James Earl Ray. Stevens claimed he heard the shot, fired from the bathroom, and saw Ray run out with a rifle. This is the same Charles Q. Stevens who just said it was a black man. Stevens became, and whose manager of the rooming house said he was so falling down drunk he didn't see anything. Stevens became the only eyewitness, the only eyewitness, I repeat, who would link the accused assassin to the murder scene. If Ray's London attorney had known of Stevens' original police statement, the quote, nigger story, his drunken condition, or his police record containing 155 arrests, it is likely that Ray would not have been extradited. During the extradition hearings, the FBI took Stevens into protective custody at posh motels, gave him money, openly paid his drinking bills at Jim's Cafe, and hid him from the press. It cost the taxpayers $31,000 to hold the state's star witness, according to the Memphis police chief.
So, recall all of the witnesses here who would not connect James Earl Ray to the rooming house. Keep in mind that the only fellow who would not only was falling down drunk, initially didn't remember anybody being killed at all, then said that it was a black man who'd killed Martin Luther King, and this fellow was apparently falling down drunk, had phoned for a cab, couldn't get up to go to that cab. He had an arrest record of 155 arrests, and was sported to $31,000 worth of drinks by the FBI, and that's $31,000 in 1968, which is a good deal more booze than it would be today. And this is the only fellow to connect James Earl Ray to the place where he supposedly fired the fatal shot from. And later in the broadcast, we're going to take a look at Charles Q. Stevens' common-law wife, Grace Walden, or Grace Stevens, and what happened to her. She contradicted his testimony, and she paid very dearly for having done that. A number of eyewitnesses maintained that the shot was actually fired from underneath the window where Ray supposedly fired the shot from, and this is important because as we play a tape talking about some connections between the Jonestown tragedy and the Martin Luther King assassination, we're going to be the subject of the autopsy evidence of Dr. Martin Luther King and where the fatal shot was fired from. The wounds that Dr. King sustained will figure into that discussion very prominently, in particular with regard to the mother of Dr. Martin Luther King, who was one of the last people who she saw King's body, and she too died under rather strange circumstances not too long after that. Continuing with the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen. Where was the gunman? Several eyewitnesses contend the gunman fired from the rooming house backyard, where bushes atop an embankment faced King's motel across the street. Yes, a grassy knoll, unquote. At the instant he was shot, Martin Luther King was leaning over a second-floor motel balcony talking to his chauffeur, Solomon Jones, who was on the ground floor. Jones said that King seemed to be lifted off the balcony by the bullet. This upward trajectory suggests a lower assassin's perch more consistent with the bushes than the second-floor window. Quote, I heard the shot and turned around and saw a man with a white sheet on his face in some bushes over there, Jones recounted. When the gunman hunkered down again, as if he were going to fire another shot, Jones took cover. When the chauffeur looked up seconds later, he thought he saw the same man, without white sheet and rifle, walk out of the bushes and casually join firemen running toward the motel. Rumor Harold Cornbread Carter told police that he happened to be drinking wine in the bushes at 6 p.m. when he heard a shot ring loudly in his ear. Cornbread looked around and saw a man flee by him so close, quote, he kicked gravel on me, unquote. An 11-year-old black youth saw a white man jump down from the bushes onto the street soon after the shot. The 11-year-old ran 100 yards to the nearby fire station, told what he saw to three firemen, and was whisked to police headquarters. Two police detectives who were surveilling King from a concealed position in the firehouse watched him get struck. They believe the shot came from the nearby bushes, not from the window 20 feet above. Bertie Reeves and Willie Auschultz, two ear witnesses located inside the rooming house, said, quote, the shot came from the bushes.
Continuing. Ballistics expert Herbert McDonnell testified at Ray's 1974 hearing that there was, quote, no way the rifle said to have killed King could have been fired from the rooming house bathroom window. After examining a dented windowsill on which the state maintains Ray rested his rifle, McDonald declared that, quote, to get the proper angle, the rifle would have to stick 6 inches into the wall. The state contends that Ray twisted himself into a contorted firing position, straddling the rim of the bathtub. Ray's attorney, Bernard Fensterwald, remarked, quote, it's inconceivable to me that no one from the defense would have examined the room to see if a shot was possible from that window. There's no proof that the bullet was fired from that window, and there's lots of evidence to show that it was from somewhere else, unquote. Dr. J.T. Francisco, who was originally assigned by the court to determine the circumstances and cause of death, testified, quote, from my findings, I could not exclude other sites than the bathroom window as the source of the bullet, unquote. Ballistics expert McDonnell also contested the FBI ballistics report, which stated, quote, due to mutilation, no conclusion could be drawn that the submitted bullet from King's body came from the submitted rifle bought by Ray. Bear in mind, too, that the submitted rifle was the one bought by Ray was found in its case after the assailant had reportedly fled from the scene, dropping his belongings on the sidewalk, that the rifle was actually in its carton. Excuse me, not its case, but its carton. Anyway, let me read that last thing to you. Ballistics expert McDonnell also contested the FBI ballistics report, which stated, quote, due to mutilation, no conclusion could be drawn that the submitted bullet from King's body came from the submitted rifle bought by Ray. McDonnell argued that an identification could have been possible if the rifle had been test-fired to examine the slugs. Well, from my own small knowledge of these things, test-firing in these cases is almost mandatory, and it's certainly a logical thing to do in a murder case of this magnitude.
Now, recall all of the ear and eyewitnesses who maintained that the shot was fired from beneath the James Earl Ray alleged assassination site, from which he supposedly fired the shot. And recall the information that we presented earlier in the broadcast, how, according to James Earl Ray, a mysterious fellow by the name of Raoul engaged him for a cross-border smuggling operation and then moved him all around the North American continent at his behest. Recall also that Robert Byron Watson testifies that a guns, gold bullion, and heroin smuggling ring was involved with the assassination of Martin Luther King. This one based in Atlanta, Georgia, and involving a number of people, including a fellow by the name of Herman Jackson. Remember the name Herman Jackson, because we're going to see him by another name, and we're going to take a look at somebody who may have been the person who fired from this clump of bushes. Returning again to the assassination of Martin Luther King by Jeff Cohen. 90 minutes before King was slain, a dark, athletically built man entered Jim's Cafe and ordered eggs and sausage, no liquor. Manager Lloyd Jowers and the waitress say they will never forget this well-dressed, sober man who fit about as well into the Skid Row Cafe as Nelson Rockefeller at a Poor People's March. The man appeared irritated as he walked to the phone twice but did not make a call. An hour after he paid his bill and left, Jowers heard an exploding sound in the back of his cafe. Jowers and the waitress conjectured that the eggs and sausage man, not Ray, killed King. When asked about suspicious persons, Jowers mentioned the eggs and sausages man to police and was told to call them if he ever showed up again. Jowers was startled the following morning when the suspicious stranger returned. A different waitress took his order, eggs and sausage. Jowers called the cops. They picked him up after breakfast. The man was apparently held by Memphis police for the FBI, who quickly released him. That night, a police captain told Jowers, "That eggs and sausage guy you put us on must have had some real connections." One phone call, and he was gone. He wasn't in the station more than an hour, unquote. 5 days later, Memphis attorney Russell X. Thompson was visited by a mystery man who introduced himself as Tony Benavides, B-E-N-A-V-I-D-E-S, and then admitted, "It's an alias," unquote. According to Thompson, quote, "Benavides claimed to know how the King assassination actually occurred, not the way it was reported in the press," unquote. Thompson's visitor said the shot did not come from the rooming house, but from, quote, "a clump of bushes on a wall across the street from the motel," unquote. Benavides' panoramic description of the murder scene convinced Thompson that his strange guest had, in fact, been an eyewitness. "I can tell you for sure I looked out that bathroom window. You could not have squeezed off a bullet and hit King from that spot. There were trees, for one thing. The angle of elevation is another." Days after the, in parentheses here, the author adds, "Days after the murder, trees that could have obstructed a second-story sniper were cleared."
Okay, going along, Benavides continued, "The gunman jumped from the wall to the sidewalk. He moved with a crowd toward the motel. He was not suspected because he was running toward the scene, not away from it." Then the author puts in parentheses, "Remember Chauffeur Jones' almost identical description." During the 75-minute conversation, Benavides claimed to be, quote, "a professional gunman," and performed a disappearing gun trick for the startled attorney. Thompson took copious notes of Benavides' talk. I believe my roommate killed King. This is Benavides talking. It will be my lousy luck that the police will arrest me and charge me with King's murder. They picked me up last Friday. The same day, the author writes in parentheses, the Eggs and Sausage Man was arrested and released. Could Benavides be the Eggs and Sausage Man? Through photographs shown to them by reporter Chastain and attorney Thompson, Jowers and the waitress have identified the Eggs and Sausage Man and Benavides as being one and the same person, Jack Youngblood. Youngblood, according to Chastain, is a marksman and soldier of fortune who has worked with the CIA against Cuba and had a book ghostwritten about his exploits during Batista's last months. A high-ranking Memphis police official told Chastain that the, quote, Eggs and Sausage Man was an FBI informant and an Army intelligence agent. Jack Youngblood contended in his conversation with Thompson that his Denver roommate, not Youngblood himself, had pulled the trigger. Youngblood provided the attorney with the address of a Denver rooming house. When Thompson investigated the Denver dwelling, he discovered that a man fitting Youngblood's description had actually lived there. And I should just mention real quickly, this Youngblood stuff gets real confusing. Remember Youngblood? Remember earlier we mentioned one of the people that was supposedly involved with a conversation about killing King, according to Byron Watson, by the name of Herman Jackson.
Also, remember that according to reporter Chastain of the Memphis Scimitar, this fellow, Jack Youngblood, was a former soldier of fortune who had been involved in the efforts against Fidel Castro of Cuba, and that he had strong intelligence connections, because this is going to figure prominently as we get on later in the broadcast. And of course, in our Guns of November broadcast, as in virtually any intelligent treatment of the Kennedy assassination, the involvement of anti-Castro Cubans and CIA soldiers of fortune and adventurers involved against Castro figure very prominently.